For more information, email news@cfru.ca.
Hey guys, get ready for your favorite environmental news program. This is Terra Informa.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
We've got another great show lined up for you this week. Get ready to take a trip to the farm. The salmon farm, that is. Correspondent Ian McKenzie does his own investigation into the Cone Commission on the decline of sockeye salmon in the Fraser River. Then our own Steve Anderson gets his hands dirty, no, not on the farm, but digs deep into the dirt on community gardens. But first, here's Steve with your weekly headlines.
I'm Steve Anderson with your wrap-up of the week's news headlines. Saturday marked the start of a two-week-long marathon protest against the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. Calgary-based TransCanada Corporation plans to build the $7 billion project to link the Alberta tar sands to refineries in Texas. Protesters opposed the pipeline have begun a sit-in in front of the White House. The first day alone saw 65 arrests. Organizers say they have more than 1,500 people signed up to take part in the demonstration, and they expect the arrests to continue. Proponents of the project say that it will bring badly needed jobs to the American economy and provide the country with a reliable source of oil. But many are concerned that spills are all but inevitable, pointing to a long list of recent pipeline ruptures. They also contend that the project will hasten the development of the tar sands, helping to speed along global warming. The Obama administration is expected to decide whether the project will be allowed to proceed before the year is out. Organizers say the protests will be a daily occurrence in front of the White House for the rest of August. The groundbreaking ceremony for a controversial new waste incinerator took place in Ontario's Durham County last week. Dozens of protesters were on hand and had to be held back by police. The plan has been fiercely debated by locals for years, with concerns only heightened by the recent news that a U.S. facility operated by the same company was fined last month for releasing carcinogenic dioxin at more than double the allowable limit. It was the plant's second violation in 4 years. Local resident Mandy Renaud told CTV that she's worried about what the incinerator will mean for air quality.
All our food is coming from lands around here, and they're going to be burning chemicals that we can't even pronounce.
But proponents say the new facility will use improved technology and that it's a better solution than landfilling the waste. The incinerator is designed to burn up to 140,000 tons of waste a year. Residents have vowed to continue the fight. Scientists in the Yukon will be running an extra test this year when they evaluate the health of the porcupine caribou herd. Researchers will be testing the animals for radiation exposure resulting from the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan this past spring. The territory's medical authorities have said they're confident there's no radiation threat, but with several First Nations depending on the herd for food, elected officials wanted to be certain. A study done after the 1986 Chernobyl disaster found the caribou were safe for consumption. And that's it for your Terra Informa news headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
You're listening to Terra Informa. I'm Marcus Peterson, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. Keep in mind that you can check out any of these news headlines from this week or past weeks online at terrainforma.ca. Plus, you can check out all of our previous shows and bask in the warm glow of community-based, volunteer-run environmental journalism. When was the last time you had a really good piece of fish? Maybe a tuna fillet in a restaurant? A nice piece of smoked lox, or maybe a fish stick out of your freezer. In any case, lovers and advocates of all things ichthyic have been waging a silent war against the fish farm industry due to its alleged impacts on wild salmon populations across Canada. In the coming weeks, lawyers at the Cone Commission of Inquiry on the Decline of Sockeye Salmon in the Fraser River will be cross-examining witnesses on the themes of aquaculture and disease. Ian McKenzie spoke to one of the witnesses, Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society, to learn more about the issues that her organization hopes to address at the inquiry, including some of the underlying issues from evidence that connects salmon farms to wild salmon declines.
The Commission of Inquiry into the Decline of Sockeye Salmon in the Fraser River, also known as the Cohen Commission, was initiated under Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government in 2009 as a response to concerns over several years of dwindling salmon returns to BC's longest river. Many causes for the decline are being considered, including habitat disturbance, predators, diseases, water temperature changes, aquaculture, and others. One industry that has received considerable attention due to its possible association with a decline is salmon farming.
None of us are saying that they are solely at fault, but we're saying that their practices are playing a role. And they're a factor in the decline of salmon and the declining health of our oceans. And so we need to tackle that.
That was Catherine Stewart, Salmon Farming Campaign Manager for the Living Ocean Society, an environmental organization based in Santula, BC, that focuses on marine conservation. Catherine has worked on environmental issues for 25 years, nearly 18 of those with Greenpeace Canada, where she was Western Regional Director. She was the Greenpeace lead negotiator with forestry companies in the campaign to protect areas of the Great Bear Rainforest on BC's central and north coast. Catherine is currently preparing to present evidence at the upcoming Cohen Commission hearings on aquaculture. I asked her how the experience has been so far.
Those of us who are participants in the inquiry had to sign a legal undertaking, and it gives us access to thousands and thousands and thousands of government and industry documents and reports and emails and briefing notes. But we can't discuss them unless we can get them introduced into evidence in the courtroom.
To begin the interview with Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society, I wanted to hear why she thinks salmon are important and how salmon farms might be passing disease to wild salmon. Why should Canadians care?
There's a lot of us who appreciate the value as a food source to human communities. Certainly the coastal First Nations in British Columbia, many nations call themselves salmon people, and the salmon are absolutely fundamental to their culture, their way of life, and their survival. It's a critical food source. Salmon are absolutely a keystone species. On the coast of BC, the ocean, the forest, the land, they're all interdependent, and salmon are the link between them. And they feed the orca whales, they feed the black and the grizzly bears, they feed the coastal wolves, who are the only wolves in the world, as far as we know, that actually actively fish for salmon as a source of protein. But more than that, they fuel the entire ecosystem. You know, a lot of people have seen those amazing photographs of the ancient old-growth trees on the BC coast, and in the riparian zone, 70% of the nitrogen that fuels the growth of those thousand-year-old cedar trees comes from the salmon, from the carcasses of salmon that are dragged into the forest by the predators, the eagles, the bears. So they're absolutely the foundation of life and functioning of that ecosystem. And when that, you know, if that starts to crumble, if we lose the salmon, there'll be a cascading effect, and we'll lose an awful lot more than just fish.
Could you please describe what the issues and concerns are about disease transference from farm salmon to wild salmon?
Sure. Well, I think people need to understand sort of what salmon farming is. It can sound fairly benign. You know, we're raising a few fish in the pens. But this is industrial-scale production. Just like pen chicken, farms are massive. They can contain anywhere from 600,000 to a million fish in a dozen or so pens. 50,000 odd fish per pen swimming around in these net cages. And like any intensive raising of an animal, when you crowd in animals in a small confined space, they will transfer disease to each other. Disease outbreaks and parasite outbreaks are common. And we all know the problems with things like avian flu, for example, in chicken farms. But that can be contained because it's land-based, whereas the net cages are just suspended in our ocean. And so any disease pathogens that are, you know, concentrated on the farms, they may catch diseases from wild stocks passing by, but, you know, then they amplify the disease because you've got all those fish confined in one area, and then they pass those diseases back to the wild fish in a very intensive way. And it can't be contained because these are just nets hung in the water, and the water flows freely in and out, and small fish will swim in and out.
For 10 years, the Living Oceans Society has been advocating for a moratorium on new open-net salmon farms. As an alternative to open-net farms, the Living Oceans Society and many other environmental organizations, including the David Suzuki Foundation, are promoting closed systems. A closed system has an impermeable barrier between the farm and the area outside of it. There are two types of closed systems: a floating tank system, such as what Agro Marine is doing near Campbell River, or as a land-based system. Closed systems have not received wide-scale adoption by the industry because of the cost associated with them, such as adopting new technology and having to collect and dispose of the waste. However, NGOs such as Living Oceans argue that the costs are simply being externalized under the current system, with the true costs being borne out by the environment and society. One of the issues with closed systems are the energy requirements to run them, and finding ways to reduce the energy input or use clean energy sources will be needed to make the closed system truly sustainable. There have been criticisms of public commissions and inquiries in the past that they are a way for governments to postpone or avoid dealing with an issue. The Cohen Commission has not been immune to this criticism. An E.D. Edwards, who has been attending the hearings in the public gallery and writing about it on his blog at coheninquirynotes.blogspot.com, had the following criticism: "I could well see many of the lawyers in this commission moving on to become dentists, as getting answers seems very similar to pulling teeth." And, "I cannot lie. It has been a tedious 57 days, with many days akin to watching a dog chasing its tail. Might as well make that dog a golden retriever. Well-intentioned, but not quite all there." But what does Catherine Stewart and the Living Oceans Society hope will result from the commission?
Well, Living Ocean Society hopes that enough information will be introduced as evidence that Justice Cohen will be led to make very strong recommendations about the actions that need to be taken to protect our wild salmon. But that won't be enough. What we need is government action. There have been commissions and investigations and inquiries before, and there's a tendency on the part of government to just say thank you very much and we'll just file that away now.
Do we know enough about marine ecosystems, salmon life cycles, and so on to confidently make absolute management decisions? And what are the implications of this?
I think we have to, as a society, and certainly our government and Department of Fisheries, we have to adjust our thinking, because we can't manage the oceans. We can't manage the salmon. What we can manage is human impacts on those, you know, on those ecosystems, on those species. We have to manage ourselves. We have to be cautious, because the information, our knowledge, is so uncertain that we absolutely have to take a precautionary approach to the decisions we make around how to manage the fishing industry, how to manage land-based sources of pollution, how to manage habitat destruction, how to manage the farm net cage aquaculture industry. And our government needs to take far more seriously the science around climate change and the need for action. But that's going to take action at a global level as well. And so that makes it even more imperative that we minimize the impacts on salmon that are directly within our control.
I asked Catherine if there was any advice that she would like to give our listeners.
You and anybody who's shopping for groceries can really, really help make a difference by just talking to the guy behind the seafood counter or the woman at the, that's managing the store, and say, I want more information. I want you to put more information on the package about where this fish came from. We can fix this. We can get those net cages out of the water and on land. We can start really cracking down on pollution and habitat destruction and give the salmon a fighting chance.
That was Catherine Stewart, Salmon Farming Campaign Manager for the Living Ocean Society. She will be part of a panel and appearing as a witness at the Commission of Inquiry on the Decline of Sockeye Salmon in the Fraser River, also known as the Cohen Commission, on September 7th and 8th. The evidentiary hearings for disease are on August 22nd to 24th, and for aquaculture on August 25th to September 8th. There are 130 seats available at the courtroom, some of those reserved for those directly involved. The remainder are available on a first-come, first-served basis. More information on the hearings, including a schedule, can be found on the official Cohen Commission website at cohencommission.ca.
Great piece, Ian. By the way, if you have any comments or questions about any of the pieces you've heard, leave us love mail or even submit a story idea of your own, shoot us a line at tara@cjsr.com or give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 236.
Hurry up, everyone. Get in the car. It's a long way to Kitimat.
All right.
Shotgun.
Coming.
Right. So which one of you tree-hucking vegan hippies can actually drive?
I can ride a bike.
These IDs are good for driving.
Useless bunch of stoners. I'll do the driving then.
Thanks, Uncle Alan.
Woohoo! We've rounded up an award-winning team of crack Terra Informa journalists, and we're taking them 3,000 kilometers across Western Canada. We're following the route of one of Canada's most controversial environmental projects in decades, the multi-billion dollar Northern Gateway Pipeline.
We're speaking to people all along the way. We're talking oil, wilderness, jobs, politics, and money. Join us to find out why people are calling this project the environmental controversy of a lifetime.
And we want you to join us on our radio adventure.
Yeah! Woohoo! We'll be broadcasting in-depth reports from Northern British Columbia in August and September. So tune in this time each week on your local community radio station.
Alex! The what? GPS says go left!
Stop poking me!
On the road again with Terra Informa.
Wow, I cannot wait to hear how that story will turn out. Keep listening in the upcoming weeks for the first installment of our Northern Gateway Pipeline documentary, which could not have happened without the generous support of our sponsors, our home station, CJSR 88.5, and the Alberta Public Interest Research Group, or APIRG. We couldn't have done it without you. Speaking of codependency, did you know that we're completely 100% volunteer-run? If you have a passion for the environment and you're interested in being a part of Terra Informa, having your name in shining lights and broadcast across the country, well, maybe not in lights, but definitely broadcast across the country, then volunteer with us and help us produce some more award-winning environmental journalism. No superhuman skills needed. Terra Informa correspondents are people just like you. Though knowing how to juggle doesn't hurt.
You're listening to Terra Informa, a syndicated environmental news program produced at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Vacant lots, old rail right-of-ways, and unused corners of city land. What comes to your mind? Dilapidation, filth, pestilence, oh my. To some, these underutilized and unloved spaces are getting a makeover as community gardens reclaim lost public spaces. These days, just about every community in the country has a garden, and they're so popular that many are struggling to find room for all of their new members. What's all the fuss about? Here's Steve Anderson to fill us in.
So we have our potatoes and our squash and our zucchini, and we're growing melons this year. Then all along our fence we have our sugar snap peas, and we have our purple beans, our green beans, our yellow beans. We have a massive raspberry bush, which is kind of getting out of hand. Our strawberry patch, we have our carrots, our beets, our squash, our zucchini. We have our chard, our arugula, our spinach, all different kinds of varieties of lettuce. And then we also have scattered throughout, we have some like native plants, we have some sunflowers, so a good variety.
So it's like a supermarket, a block from campus, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. And if you volunteer, you get to taste all of it.
That was Melanie Alexander taking me on a tour of the campus community garden at the University of Alberta. Today we're going to visit three gardens. We'll be talking to Randy Lamb of the White Horse Community Garden and Jane Hanlon from Climate Action Niagara, which has actually helped set up 15 gardens all the way from Hamilton to St. Catharines. They're going to tell us a bit about the gardens, why they're so popular, and how they work. To begin with, I asked Randy about the benefits of community gardens.
And a lot of people who are living in smaller spaces now, renting apartments, they don't have the opportunity to grow in the city, to have a gardening space, that is. So what our community does in general is it provides all of that, a place to go to recreate, to garden, to hang out with other people, and to grow some good, healthy food in the meantime.
I think it's a really nice feeling to be able to actually produce your own food. I think we have become really disconnected with our food. We don't really see how it grows, where it comes from, what's put into it. So there's kind of this weird feeling when you come to the garden and we're planting and people see peas for the first time. And they're like, we're actually putting peas in the ground and peas come from peas. And there's a really nice connection getting back in touch with our food and where it comes from. And also being in control of what goes on it. So we're completely organic here. So being in control of what goes into our food and eating things that are actually good for us.
Jane really agreed with Melanie about the importance of gardens as a source of healthy food. In fact, she sees them as springboards to a lifetime of healthy eating.
It supports the local food economy. Those who become accustomed to eating fresh food are more likely to shop at their local markets. That supports local farmers, which supports more green space. There has been a study with children that indicates children that can recognize foods at very young ages are approximately 80 times more likely to eat them as adults. So it becoming a family activity is beneficial to the next generation.
One thing that everyone I talked to said is that the benefits of gardens aren't just the obvious things like healthy food and exercise. Gardens really bring a neighborhood together. They get people outside and interacting in a way that's largely lost in modern cities.
For me, I thought everyone came to garden. Yes, like gardening is like a really cool skill to learn, but I find that people mostly stay for the community. Just last year, we started doing salad parties, which we harvest the lettuce in our garden, and everyone brings one salad ingredient, so like a berry or nut, and then I bring the dressings, and we sit in the front lawn, and we eat these salads, and it seems like such a simple thing, but it actually really makes people come, because they start to realize how many similarities they have with the other people at the garden. They build community, and I think that's what people come back for, more so than the garden itself.
The personal benefits are huge. There's the physical activity, a sense of community. A community garden has a clientele, shall we say, that people like to share knowledge, sharing food. There's always a bounty left over, and there's discussion on what to do with it. The community gardening also can rejuvenate a neighborhood. It can reduce crime. It reduces carbon, so it's an air purifier. It's just a great, healthy exercise that's feel good all around.
Jane mentioned food being left over at the end of the year. That brings up an important aspect of the gardens. For some people, they're a hobby, and that's great. But for low-income families, they can be an important source of affordable fruits and vegetables. And a lot of gardens choose to put aside part of what they grow so that local food banks and shelters can offer more than just canned beans and macaroni to their clients.
There's a program now that helps out the food security agencies called Plantaro Growaro. And I know they have them in Manitoba and Vancouver, and we've definitely got it up here in Whitehorse, where you dedicate a part of your row towards the food security. And so what happens here is every Wednesday, we have volunteers picking from designated areas in the beds and delivering that food to the local food bank, which helps out, you know, a lot of people. So food security was one of the origins to get the garden started. And we've been continuing that. Last year we donated almost 500 pounds of fresh produce to the food bank, and that really helps out. And the way we do that, if people find themselves with, say, you know, a four-foot row of lettuce, and it's way beyond what they could eat, we have these marked stakes that they put into the ground, and when the volunteers see a stake, a colored stake with PAR on it, they know that they can harvest part of that row and deliver it to the food bank the next day.
Okay, so we've heard about the benefits of community gardens, but how do they work? Well, they tend to be designed by each individual community, so each one's a bit different. A common way of doing things is to divide the garden up into plots and assign one to each member. There are also usually some common areas that are cared for collectively, like potato patches, raspberry bushes, little herb gardens, that sort of thing. Fees are usually kept fairly minimal, just enough to cover the cost of tools and basic supplies.
For $20 a year garden membership, you get access to the tools and compost and water and occasionally seeds and transplant.
But there are also other ways of organizing a garden. Melanie explained that the student-run garden that she coordinates is operated as a collective.
So we're completely a collective, so no one has a separate plot. We also, because we're funded through ECOS, the Environmental Coordination Office of Students, we do get our seeds taken care of. So no one has to pay any upfront fees. We run completely on volunteers, so we plant in May together, we weed together, we harvest together, and we share it all equally.
The appearance of gardens varies as well. If the soil's good, whole areas can be plowed and planted. Often there are berry bushes, fruit trees, and flowers along the borders to make the whole area a little more inviting. In cases where the soil is less favorable, raised beds can be built. They're essentially great big wooden boxes, 2 or 3 feet deep, that sit right on top of the ground and are filled with soil.
We have about 50 raised beds, which we've been every couple years we add a few more new beds. We apply for various grants or get volunteer labor and donate to build new beds, but it's come a long way. We've been there about 14 years, and we started with about 15 beds, and now there's about 60 gardeners there, so we've pretty well quadrupled in size.
There are also rooftop gardens, which may use raised beds or just large flower pots. Inuvik, some 200 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle, has even converted an old hockey rink into an absolutely enormous greenhouse for its garden. It's a pretty brilliant solution for a community where fresh veggies cost an arm and a leg, not to mention coming with quite a carbon footprint. So there are lots of different models that gardens can follow, and you pretty much just have to poke around your community and see what's available. But once you find one, how do you get started? Well, the good news is that there's lots of help.
We have specific workshops to help guide people. We have a gardener's orientation session, and we have sometimes transplants available, but being there as part of a gardening community, there's lots of new gardeners and lots of master gardeners, and just by talking to your neighbors in the neighboring beds, you pick up what they're doing. You can ask them, you know, how do I plant this? How do I grow this? When do I plant it? So there's a lot of sharing of gardening knowledge there.
We're not very high maintenance, so that helps. If there's weeds in our garden, we're okay with it. If our peas didn't come up quite well, we're okay with it. So it's a really safe place to learn how to garden and really good community because we do have a couple really, really knowledgeable gardeners that come out, so you can learn a lot from them. But if you kind of want to take it slow and just weed and do a couple things, you can do that as well.
So sort of a good learning experience then.
Yeah, and we always joke that we're an experimental garden, so we're not really a garden, we're just experimenting. So that way we can protect ourselves if we totally mess something up.
So even if you're brand new to gardening, there's plenty of help. You may be thinking, well, that's all fine and good, but it's August, it's a little late to be starting a garden. And you're right. But with the growing interest in community gardens, many are starting to burst at the seams, and waiting lists aren't uncommon. So if you think community gardening is something you might like to try, now's the time to sign up. For Terran Forma, I'm Steve Anderson.
Well, that's all we got for this week. Tune in next week for your next environmental news fix. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm your host, Marcus Peterson. Ciao.